Swamiji wrote those songs, many songs, 400 pieces of music actually, in an effort to find an easier way to communicate both the spirit and the teachings. Of course, the style of music is Western-based, and he has been very interested to see if it would also be enjoyable to Indian audiences. We were talking last night, some of us, about the very beginnings of Ananda in India in November of 2003. When Swamiji first came here, a few of us from America came with him. We have to help. And we were staying in a place called the Om Guest House, which was in some other part of town. I don't know exactly where it is. I can't orient myself. We sort of took over that place for a few weeks until they were able to move into 10 by 8, which took a while. So I'll just keep talking and you'll keep tinkering and we'll figure it out. Okay. But I remember in the basement of that house, a man named Ashwani and his wife came over, and Swamiji had a small group of us stand up and sing a few of these songs. Dharmadas and Nirmala, who were very solid in the singing, and others of us who were less so. And then he turned really intently. Do you like it? Do you like it? And he was very pleased. Maybe they were just being gracious. But they said, oh yes, I think that'll go well. So it's part of the project, and this is actually directly related to my subject today, which is trying to blend cultures, not for any political reason but because at this time and in this place, an avatar and a line of masters have come in keeping with the tradition that the Bhagavad Gita describes, that when the world needs a restoration of right understanding, a restoration of harmony, the divine responds to that. That even though we live in this world with the feeling that we're in charge, making all these decisions, in fact, we are moving in a very complicated sea of spirit, which of course is an understanding that India has always held. But much more profoundly than we think of on a day-to-day basis, the masters are in charge and watching. Swamiji writes in one of the last chapters of his autobiography, The Path, when he's talking about the time when Yogananda left this world, and the promise of his continuing guidance, the promise even of his return in a future incarnation. And Swamiji writes very movingly about these masters and the spiritual families that they draw around them, and how over many, many cycles of time, incarnations for our souls and much longer cycles in the cosmos, that these great spiritual families, as he says, form great spiritual nations. And Swamiji writes, far more than most people realize, the destiny of the world is in the hands of these great ones. And even political leaders and presidents and villains and heroes are moved by that, by the direct intercession of these masters. In 1936, when Yogananda came from America to visit India, the only trip back he made after he left in 1920, he passed through Europe. And at that point, Hitler was just beginning to assert his power. And Master made the amazing statement that Hitler had great power. He had a certain amount of yogic power in the sense that he had tuned into cosmic forces. And Master said at that point, the direction that Hitler would take that power was undecided, that it could have gone for evil or it could have gone for good. And Master tried to make an appointment to meet with him when he was in Germany, obviously hoping to influencing him toward the good. But it was not Divine Mother's will that it happened. And that meeting never happened, and everything went forward from there. But Master said later, toward the end of World War II, when Hitler had so much power, that at a certain point he made a foolish military decision, and he divided his forces onto two fronts. Master said that the idea of dividing his forces, which led to his defeat, was put into his mind by the Himalayan masters. That the masters were really in charge of the nations. The karma had run its course. There was karma that had to be paid by everybody involved, but it was running its course, and they stepped in because otherwise, Master said, on a human plane, Hitler had too much power, and he had to be misled. I heard another story where Stalin, at a critical moment in his evil career, had gotten on a train to go and initiate some very negative force of energy. The details escape me at the moment. And he was on this train heading to do that, and he felt he was having a heart attack. And so he turned around and went back to his capital, and that campaign was abandoned. He was not having a heart attack. He just felt as if he were. Master said that was created by the Himalayan masters because Stalin had a certain force to do evil, but the karma of the planet was different, and so they pushed him back. Very strange, isn't it? But it really puts us into the understanding that there are tremendous forces always at work here, and that it behooves us to cooperate with those forces. Now, our topic today is about three of the Hindu deities. It has been my habit when arranging this tour, especially this one, because there was a certain amount of confusion about when I would come and what I would do because of our Finding Happiness movie and various things. The details are unimportant. So pretty much whatever was suggested to me, I said, okay, if that's what you all think is a good idea, I'll do it. Only when I was really here and I realized what I had agreed to speak about today, did the sheer folly of it occur to me to try to stand up in front of an Indian audience and talk about Indian deities. So I've had to try to figure out a way to pick this up from a string that will work for all of us. Swamiji remarked on one occasion that there's two ways to know a country. He said, either you live there for many years or you visit for one day. And he said, often when you drop in for a very brief period of time, you actually receive clear impressions that don't later get confused by everyday life. So even though someone might not know something in depth, they still can draw an understanding from it that has some truth in it. So I want to start by explaining a number of things related to the deities, which I think will be helpful for everyone. My first trips to India, starting in 1986, in fact, all of my trips to India until Swami Kriyananda moved here in 2003, were in the context of leading a pilgrimage of American devotees, mostly disciples of this line of gurus, who wanted to come to India and visit the places related to our path, where Master lived, where Sri Yukteswar is buried, where Lahiri Mahashaya lived. In those, at the beginning years, we could go up to Kashmir and we could see the Shankaracharya temple up there. After a while, of course, we weren't able to visit safely. That cycle of places. So I came about a dozen times on that cycle. The first trip we took to India, there were four Americans leading the trip. Only one of us had ever been to India before. So it was a bit of letting our guide tell us and then my turning around and telling them. But I did understand the heart of the spiritual path, because even though I knew nothing about this place or this culture in that sense, Master had taken the essence of self-realization, not of Hinduism, but of self-realization, which of course is the power behind all true religions. The power of Sanatana Dharma animates Hinduism, Judaism, Christianity, everything that is a true expression of true principles. But when Master brought it to America, he actually left almost all of Hinduism behind. He sang only a few chants that ever even referred to the deities. He did not sing, you know, he wrote a chant for Radha and Krishna, spirit and nature, he called it. But he did not, for the most part, do ceremonies or pujas or even try to talk to the disciples about all the accoutrements, which Swamiji later called the way of awakening is the inner reality, the way of belief is the outer core that's put on that. Swamiji later wrote a book called The Hindu Way of Awakening, from which I will draw much of what I say today. So my introduction to your culture, which I also consider my culture because the soul, it lives in many places, and I've certainly been part of this before, has been entirely and only through the principles of self-realization. And even when we came back, I say back because it's like from another life, came back to India, I was bringing Americans and trying to help them draw out of this culture, not Hinduism, about which I know almost nothing really, but self-realization, which is exemplified by certain aspects of what we see here, because deep and powerful truths have been maintained through much of what is the practice of the religion at this point. Not all, but much. Still, all the deities and so on, even though there was a certain joyous recognition, I had to come at it from my unique position. And we would often be in Calcutta during the Kali Puja time. And as you all know, the neighborhoods would all gather together and every neighborhood would make a shrine, and some of them were just extraordinary. And of course, as Americans, we were just mesmerized by the whole experience. It was nothing that even hints at it ever happens in our country. So we would often walk through the streets in the neighborhoods and we would enjoy the chanting. And I remember one particular day, the crowds were, and you know, there would be Goddess Kali, and with her tongue and her bloody heads, and you all know what she looks like. She doesn't fit. You know, Americans are really tidy. You know, she doesn't really fit the tidy picture of how we like to think about religion. Even though when you think about Christianity with Jesus hanging on the cross, it's a fairly gory symbol by itself too. But in any case, I was always just, I tried to participate, but I just wasn't sure. And one day, I was in a crowd, and I was sort of toward the back, and like crowds are, they kept pushing imperceptibly, and I kept backing up and backing up as far as I could to give space. And suddenly, without realizing it, until I turned around, I was inches away from a huge statue of Kali. And I didn't know she was there until I turned like this, and all of a sudden, in her full glory, she's right there, like this. And it was so startling to me, both the image itself and the suddenness of her intrusion on my life, that I looked at her very seriously, and I said, "What is this? What is this about?" And it was actually very interesting because she answered me. And I remembered all that Swamiji has taught us about self-realization and how this world works. Just as I was describing, much of what we think is being done by human egos is often being done from a divine source. But even still, Master said, he didn't say God inspired Hitler. He said the Himalayan masters inspired Hitler. Yogananda himself took credit for inspiring Harry Truman when he was president to enter the Korean War and to defend against the incursion of communism. Master said, "I put that thought in President Truman's mind," to speaking himself, because he felt it was important that communism be stopped from sweeping through that part of the world. Now, Swamiji has often reminded us that God needs instruments, that this world is created by forces, whether they be human incarnations, deathless masters, angelic beings. But just as we see in the world that we can perceive with the senses, how things follow an orderly expression. Creative thoughts come into our minds, and then we execute them with the help of others. Everything has to go through its necessary stages. The architect has a beautiful inspiration. He has to get the draftsman to draw the plans. He has to explain it to the contractor, who has to hire the workers. And step by step, things happen. Everything we see in the world we perceive with our senses is a symbol of how all of creation works. So a symbol like Kali did not just materialize without the agency of some great rishi at some point. And some great rishi had a perception of the nature of the universe which was encapsulated in this image. And I'm standing there looking at Kali, and she's more or less saying to me, "I am life, I am reality." And I looked at all those contradictory forces, and somehow or another, the meaning behind all of it, not intellectually, I couldn't write a treatise, but she looks like life itself. She really does. If you tune into her reality, all the contradictions, the blessing and the fears and the life and the death, it's all just happening right in front of you. And in many ways, it communicates more powerfully than if you have to stop and think it through. And from that moment, and then I thought some rishi in a state of great superconsciousness perceived this, created it, and because he imbued it with his understanding, and because certainly it was a superconscious image when he saw it, other people were able to receive, even until now. Now, Swamiji writes, and there's another book that is not yet published in India, but I hope will be soon. It's called The Yugas, and it was written by two members of Ananda, Joseph Selby and David Steinmetz. Fascinating book about the yuga cycles. But this is the part that's relevant here. Thinking of Satya Yuga, a time when people were able to be directly connected to the infinite power, the planet as a whole was able to move in harmony with cosmic forces, to see in this world the interrelationship of things, to understand the power of the rivers and the power of the planets, and not just as an idea, but as an actual experience. In such an age, symbols would not be needed, because people would live with a direct perception. You know, many times when saints in our time and masters, when they ascend to a direct experience of cosmic consciousness, they don't have to do the ceremonies, they don't have to have the murtis, because all of those were just the steps that they took to get to that reality. Much of the way of belief is to help us get to the way of awakening. So in that age, mankind as a whole didn't need any of this. But as the age began to descend, the rishis had to think, how could they keep these truths alive? The best known example of that is the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, where these great masters and the principles that they demonstrated in their lives were preserved as stories, so that all through the Kali Yuga time, when people couldn't grasp it directly, we could still hear these stories. As Master writes in Autobiography of a Yogi, it's those epics have preserved the truth of Sanatana Dharma very dynamically and effectively. The rishis knew what they were doing. And so in the book about the yugas, Joseph Selby writes about how they had to try to think of how to give people of lower consciousness access to these truths as they began to slip away from everyday awareness. So the symbols and the mantras, and then gradually as the age descended, the prayers and the rituals were added in as a way to attune men's minds when they were not naturally attuned anymore to be able to get back to these states. And, of course, through the Kali Yuga period, the symbols themselves become almost more important than what they represent, because people forget that this is a doorway, not an end in itself. But God is kind, as it says in the Gita, in whatever way we worship, in that way God can come to us. And it's the sincerity of the heart that draws the divine response. The methods are whatever methods we use, but it's the sincerity of the heart that draws it. So all of this came to me when I was nose to nose with Kali, trying to just feel why she's here and what she's doing. So I've never made a deep study of any of these deities because that side of it has not felt important to me. It's not that it's not important to someone, it's just not necessary for me. So what I've taken from it are the bits and pieces that integrate into the spiritual life that I'm living. Now this is another part of where I started with these masters descending and Yogananda coming into this particular time. I've been sharing this since I arrived in India because, as Devendra expressed, Swamiji asked me to, as he put it, consider the whole world my community. I've been responsible with my husband for one aspect of Ananda, and he essentially said, you need to take down the boundaries and be responsible, be an ambassador for Master's teachings. At the time that he said that, which was about a year and a half before he died, I didn't realize how soon he would be off the planet. But the responsibility that he offered me, especially after Swamiji left, is to realize that Swamiji always took responsibility on a level that no other disciple seemed to be able to understand, not merely for his own relationship to Master, but responsibility for the whole reason that Master incarnated on the planet. And in this, he also set an example for the rest of us. You know, we have chosen to be disciples of this line of gurus at a time when their mission is just beginning to make itself felt. It's not a time when it's been established for hundreds or thousands of years and we just step into something that is already defined itself. Instead, Master's life has ended relatively soon, relatively recently in the great scheme of things, and we are but a handful who even really know of the power and significance of this line. But more than that, Master defined that he had a very specific mission, not merely for the individual disciples, but for the whole direction of the globe, of what Sri Yukteswar described as the ascent now of Dwapara Yuga and setting a new pattern. And Master described this as the relationship between Jesus and Babaji, and the relationship between the East and the West. And he was asked by Babaji to teach from the Gita and from the New Testament, the Bible and the Gita, and to show that the essential truths of both these scriptures, which seem to come from different sides of the world, from completely different realities, are actually one teaching. And Jesus is integral to Master's mission because of his responsibility for Western spirituality, is how Master describes it, and Krishna Babaji are responsible for the Eastern side, and now it must come together. Now, the contribution of the East of India, particularly, to this teaching is self-evident. Master came from Bengal and came as a representative of India. Everything about him radiated that culture. But when he left India, he went to Sri Yukteswar, and Sri Yukteswar's blessing to him was, forget that you were born in India and don't become an American. He said, take the best of both worlds and bring them together. And that's, again, what Master always said. And he talked about the eternal spirituality of the East, and then he talked about the practical efficiency of the West. So I've been trying to understand, because I'm not speaking for myself, I'm speaking on behalf of the assignment that Swamiji gave me. This is not just me sitting at my dinner table having interesting conversation. I'm trying to understand what he means by that. And the practical side of America is easy for me to grasp, being a practical American. Even as Americans go, I'm pretty practical. I like things that make a tangible contribution. Even though I have a far-ranging interest in many things, I always want to bring them down to some practical application. Mere speculation, I'm not good at. I can't think clearly unless it's grounded in something helpful. So here we are with Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. And Swamiji writes about this in The Hindu Way of Awakening, which, if you haven't read that book, it's very interesting to read. If you find it a little difficult to read, I have done a study course on it actually twice. And if you go on to just Google my name, you'll eventually find it. I was actually reading Hindu Way of Awakening myself, straining to understand what Swami was saying. And it occurred to me that a lot of other people probably were too. So that was the beginning of what I've done of study courses of over the last 15 years of many, many of Swami's books. Because Swamiji lived at the mountaintop, and he would skip along the mountaintop. And sometimes some of the rest of us need to start in the valley and walk all the way up to try to figure out how we got there. So he writes about, you know, this famous Hindu trinity as not really, as many people misunderstand, thinking it belongs to the Christian trinity of Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. He says it simply is not a match. What these three aspects represent, the creator, the preserver, and the destroyer, is how creation itself works. What they symbolize is our experience of life as we're living it. And there are many, many other esoteric aspects and many, many overlays of traditions and so on, which I will follow Swamiji's advice. He more or less disregarded. He answers more of them than I will answer, but he felt that they were not the real point. So he's comparing these three entities to the Indian trio of Om, Tat, Sat, God beyond creation and God within creation and God planted as an individual spirit in all of us. And these three he describes as different aspects of the Om vibration. Now, the whole discussion of Om is an enormous study in itself and is actually part of the Kriya, the different levels of Kriya practice, which I know many of you have been through. because Master, pulling from all these many traditions, pulled the attunement with Om as one of the fundamental spiritual practices of self-realization as he brought it to us. Communion with Om, he said, with the sound of Om within us, is one of the easiest ways to contact the Spirit. It's one of the easiest ways to experience the peace of God all around us. The Om vibration, as I said, many things can be said about it, but one of the ways to understand it is it is the medium, the vibration itself, which is both sound and light, from the one power of Spirit, completely still, as the Masters describe it, it begins to vibrate, and then it gives the impression of all this separateness. I can't and don't want to go into that in much greater detail because it takes us to a place that I'm not really competent to convey. But you can feel it in many different ways, as well as experiencing it when you attune yourself through the right practices. Swamiji talked about it in this way once. He was saying, because this world appears to be so complicated, we naturally imagine that the source of this world that we see must be equally complicated. And in those many reversals which happen when you get into true spirituality, he was saying the closer you get to the source, you see, the more all of the dissonant vibrations resolve. And so what you have at the source is absolute stillness and simplicity. And he was explaining this is also why the more elevated the saints become, the more childlike they become in their spirit. Instead of being more and more complicated and confused, they become more and more simple. Jesus put it, "Suffer little children to come unto me, for of such is the kingdom of God." And so this little spirit of simplicity is when all the dualities resolve. Now, in order to get to that simplicity, we have to learn how to work with all this complexity. And all of this complexity being an expression of this Om vibration, these symbols of these three aspects of the Om then become a very, very useful way for us to understand. And in their simplest terms, this is what's being described. Everything in creation begins. As long as we're working in the cycle of time, we experience that everything has a beginning. And then there is a period of time where it continues to exist in a form more or less like what we've been experiencing. And then inevitably, whatever there is in creation shifts, changes, and mutates into something else. Now, our difficulty in life is that instead of understanding that this is a constant, irresistible, everlasting flow of energy, is that we grab little pieces of it. And we want little pieces of it to be just exactly as they are. And we forget that this is always energy in motion. And the more we can become adept at these three aspects of creation, the more effectively we can live in this world, the happier we can live in this world, and the more all the confusion that we experience around us will resolve into this simplicity. Just a moment. I was talking to a friend of mine just very recently. I'm going to take this from another angle. To be able to flow with all these energies is not really about religion. You know, it's not about any outward ways that we live. It's how we actually experience life and how we relate to it. A friend of mine, a woman, was on this spiritual path. Her husband supported her in her interest but really himself apparently had no particular interest in the path. In fact, he was a very worldly man. He had made a great deal of money. He'd been through the Brahma period of creating a great deal of money. Now he was in the Vishnu period of enjoying his money. And just, he traveled all over the world. He took his wife to the most expensive places. He never looked at the price of anything. He just had created what he wanted. Now he was just cruising along on it. And he was strong and vibrant and utterly engaged in a sensual life, really. And one day when he was out exercising, he was a man of maybe in his late 50s at that point, he was out running, he was an athlete, and he had a pain in his back. And the pain didn't go away. So he went finally to a doctor to see what it was. And when they examined him carefully, his spine was completely infected with cancer. And the first he knew of it was the pain in his back running. And when he went into the hospital to be examined, he never came out because it had advanced to the point, you know, when cancer is growing close to nerves, you might not know it's there at all until it touches. And then as soon as it touches, it's a completely different experience, which is why sometimes cancers advance in those parts of the body without your knowing it until it's too invasive. Now, my expectation of this man, given the way he was living, actually, it was a very salutary lesson for me. He went into the hospital. They immediately realized that there was really nothing they could do for him, and it had just crossed over to the point where it was just taking his life away from him. And in fact, at a certain point, he... let me go into the middle of this. So I went to see him in the hospital, and here is a man who had been... He was a self-made millionaire. He really knew how to create. He had retired early. He had enjoyed what he had. And all of a sudden, Shiva had taken an interest in him. And to his credit, and it was very touching to me, his wife, who supposedly was involved in spiritual things, was completely unhinged. She'd just lost contact with everything that she knew. He was just lying comfortably in bed. And when I came in, he welcomed me cheerfully, and he said, "I have no complaints. It's been a great life." He said, "If it's now over," he said, it would be rude of me to say anything but thank you," like this. And then he had some kind of a crisis, and they put him on a life support system. And everyone knew that he would not have wanted to stay there. So they decided to turn off the life support at 3:00 on Tuesday afternoon. And he'd been mostly unconscious since they put him onto that system. And they wanted me to be there. And it's very odd, you know, that you know the exact moment and hour of your death, but he had been mostly unconscious. So I arrived there at 3:00 or just before that with rose petals and Ganges water and a little bit of an idea of how we could try to make this work better. The man is fully conscious. He can't speak because he has this system. He's absolutely wide awake, and you can see that he's perfectly clear. And no hint of fear in his eyes, just complete relaxation. He's, you know, giving as much energy as he can to his wife, who's quite upset. And no agitation, nothing. Just completely, okay, why would I cling? You know, I've adapted to everything else that's come. And they actually insisted, this was me in the medical profession, they insisted on giving him a heavy sedative before they turned off the machine. I really didn't want them to, because it was self-evident that this man could transition without any assistance. But the doctors couldn't handle it. Really, it was the doctors who couldn't bear the idea of just letting him die without drugging him. So I blessed him and prayed to Master that his consciousness could just pull away from the drugs, which I'm sure it did. And then they just let him go. Now, that rather worldly example, which was not at all worldly at the end, you know, just sort of is a model that all of us have to realize. We have very different stages in our lives. We have very different inclinations. But if we're going to live successfully, all three of these symbols need to be deeply integrated. It's very important, both as devotees and as human beings, and I'll start with the Brahma energy, we really have to participate in the creation of our lives. And this is that doesn't mean that everybody in the world is a creative artist, although Swamiji has written a book about every aspect of life, really. This one is called Art as a Path to Self-Realization. I believe that's the title of it now. It's been called Art as a Hidden Message also. It's a fascinating book about the creative process. And what happens after you read that book is what he's really describing without ever saying it, is he's trying to give us an understanding of how we can tune in to that aspect of creation which is ever new. Now, when we describe God himself with the best word that we have, which is Satchitananda, and Master described that as ever, ever conscious, ever existing, ever new joy. And Master added that phrase, ever new, to it. And the ever-new part of it helps us to understand how an eternity of joy is not boring. I mean, that may sound silly, but what we have to realize is that every moment of creation is a completely new reality, that everything shifts from moment to moment. Sometimes when people are trying to understand, I've certainly experienced this in my life, and I've learned it slowly. Often, when I need an answer to a question and it doesn't come because it's not time yet to know, because the exact conditions that are required for clarity to be there simply haven't arrived. And oftentimes, when the decision is finally needed, then all the conditions will be just in place and we'll know. When I first met Swami Kriyananda, even though I had this absolute commitment to him, I had not read Autobiography of a Yogi. I owned it, but I hadn't been able to read it. I was very austere in my attitude towards spiritual life, and I was very suspicious of phenomenon. And Lahiri Mahashaya materializes in a wheat field about page 9 of that book. And that was about the point where I closed it, because I couldn't rise to the level that book was asking of me until I met Swamiji, and somehow his acceptance of Master came into me, and I immediately opened the book and couldn't understand why I didn't love it before, because I loved it then. But I had been guided in my life up to that point, in my spiritual life, which had been going on for about 4 years, by Paramahansa Ramakrishna and Vivekananda, and I would go to their temples in America, and I feel a very deep attunement with Ramakrishna. When we came on that first pilgrimage trip and I went to the temple in Dakshineshwar, I was beside myself with... I was so thrilled, and I'd been reading about that place for 20 years, and to finally put my feet right where he was. So it was not a small connection, but I couldn't make a life out of my relationship with Ramakrishna, and I never took initiation. I just couldn't figure out how it worked. And when Swamiji came, yeah, I could see how it would work, and I just went with him. But the whole question of Master Vyogananda and Ramakrishna on the other side of Swamiji, so to speak, I didn't know what to do with it. So my conclusion was that I don't have the intuition to know. And the only way I could ever have intuition to know is I'm going to have to do something to change my consciousness. So the obvious thing to do is to go where Swami is and learn from him. And then that will change my consciousness. And then in the hour that I need to know, I will know. And so I did exactly that. And about a year after living at Ananda Village, without having any doubt about my connection to Swami, I woke up one morning and realized I could just see it, that Ramakrishna had held me in his arms and carried me and handed me over. I learned later there's an actual upaguru, there's a concept for that, the one who takes care of you until you're delivered. And it was crystal clear to me that that's what was needed, and it never would have been if I had stood in one place and waited to know if it would be clear, because the time of everything is exactly what has to happen. So the necessity, what I was saying about that, is that every single minute is a change, because we learn something or we fail to learn something, we expand our awareness or we contract it. In the Bible it says, Jesus says just before he's crucified, and he's speaking to God about whether or not this colossal misunderstanding on the part of the people he has come to help, is there any way that they can be enlightened? That's what he's concerned about. He's not concerned about dying, he's concerned about their karmic mistake. And so, spare me from this hour, he says. But then he says, for this hour was I born. Now, in the drama of the life of Jesus, those words just ring through the cosmos. But what's fascinating to realize is every one of us can say that. We have, all of our millions of incarnations have all come to a perfect focus right now, right this minute. And whether or not we begin to decline from this point or whether we continue to expand, this is the ever-new creation of a new consciousness on our part. Are we participating at all times in creating a new reality for ourselves? And we are inadvertently, but what is that reality? And to deeply absorb into our own awareness the fact that there is nothing fixed, absolutely nothing fixed about our consciousness. We are a pattern of energy. And it even though it's beneficial to gain self-awareness, to understand why we are the way we are, what influences have brought us to this point, what habits we've picked up. I was raised in a family that loved words and loved conversation. And my brother was a champion debater, and I was part of a debate team for a while. And we really liked to argue, not fight exactly, but have arguments in the sense of debate. Conversation, to me, was everybody takes turns putting out their best arguments. And you have your little point, and you put out your arguments, and then you wait, and the next person puts out his arguments, and then you respond. And even if it's very cordial, it's always everybody asserts their strongest. I didn't know that that wasn't actually conversation. And I was often really bewildered why people didn't respond when I put out all my best arguments. My husband tried to tell me for years, but I was 50 years old before I got that. That I had been raised in such a way that it was just random and not really very much of a good idea. You encourage people's point of view. You listen. You don't try to overpower them with your reasons like this. So it's very helpful to know who you are and what you're doing and why you're doing it. Let me just a moment, I have to find the thought because I lost it for a second. Anyway, it's very helpful to a certain extent to know that, but what we also, oh yes, that's it. But we also have to realize that all of that is just a habit. And even a habit is not a fixed thing. A habit is a point of view that's been repeated enough times that it's a pattern in your chakras, and so every time a decision has to be made, there's a whirlpool of energy that's going to pull you in that direction. It's the way you're tilted, right? But you can shift that absolutely easily. Now, the reason we find it difficult to recreate ourselves is because committed, a certain amount of energy has been spent, and that energy has formed itself into these powerful patterns, and they can't be undone except by a commensurate energy. So that energy either has to be applied slowly and methodically over, you know, years of meditation and practice, or in theory, as Master said, a habit can be changed in an instant if you put the same amount of energy into changing it that you put into creating it. Understand? So even after I realized that debate is not conversation, that's still my fallback position. When I grow impatient, I just put out my strongest reasons and hope to persuade, which is what I'm doing now. I made a profession out of it, too. I was on an airplane coming from somewhere to somewhere since I got to India, Mumbai to Delhi. There was a little girl. Her father was next to me, and the little girl was on the other side. The little girl talked continuously from Mumbai to Delhi. And she had a fairly interesting point of view, but she just chattered about what she was seeing. She was explaining things to her father about her relatives and looking out the window and talking about the color. Just absolutely did not stop. And I said to the father, I was like that, and it worked out all right for me. I've made a profession out of it. You know, I met another little girl who was the same type at the swimming pool. And she was there with her mother, and the only time she stopped talking was when she was actually underwater. But as soon as she came up, she started in again, explaining her perception of what happened underwater. I again put my arm around the mother. She can be a writer and a speaker. It's okay. You'll see, it'll be all right, because the mother's looking like this. In any case, that the absorption of the symbol, this is what I'm trying to say, of the Creator is there to show us what is possible for us. And so the most important way, I think, to absorb this is not merely artistic creativity, which is, for many reasons, also highly desirable, because it's a way of art attunes us to the feeling side of our nature. And the feeling side of our nature is where intuition is. When we work only with our mental descriptions and our reasonable understandings of it, we're standing on one leg. We're crippling ourselves. Because in the end, in the beginning, our true nature is feeling. The power of the spirit is a feeling. When we actually come in contact with the Om vibration, when we actually come in contact with the divine, it's not an abstract idea. We don't experience it as a good idea. We experience it as something that is a vibration of feeling into which we are absorbed, that afterwards we can also understand with our minds and need to, but we don't experience it in a dry way. We experience it with everything that we are. And we need to use all our energy at all times to bring us more into harmony with that. And this is where Swami writes, art as a path to self-realization. Art is learning how to let our feeling nature flow through us, to see what our feelings are, and then gradually to elevate them. I'm on the back wall here is this painting by Dana Anderson, which Swamiji asked her to do to illustrate the cover of the Bhagavad Gita. Now, how do you illustrate the Bhagavad Gita and put it into a picture? The picture that's usually given, and we've seen beautiful ones, you see Krishna standing in the chariot with the five gorgeous white horses and Arjuna standing behind him. I mean, that's a realistic portrayal of the events of the book. And some of those pictures are so magnificent that you feel the whole power there. But Dana chose to define it in abstract terms, and when you all walk out of this room in the break, in just a moment you can look at the picture. So there's no specific, like, intellectual concept in the picture. She had to convey the whole thing through the feeling of it. And she's a very gifted artist, and I love to just stand and look at the pieces of her painting, which are all through this center and all through the ashram, and just try to take from that feeling, like, what was she creating? What was the feeling that was going through her when she was doing that? And then just see all the different pieces and how it all comes together. It symbolizes all of those feelings. Now, if we're creative in that way, you can do that when you're cooking, you can do that when you're painting, you can do that when you're singing, you can do it when you're dancing. You don't have to be good at it. Swami's mother was fond of saying, if something is worth doing, it's worth doing badly, which I've always loved. Because if we just want to express and create and show who we are, it doesn't have to be magnificent as long as it's a sincere expression of who we are. And all the different ways that we can remind ourselves that this world is ever new. And each time a difficulty comes to us, a problem that we have to face, a sense of discouragement, a conflict that we've had to deal with, a repeating pattern of inadequacy or inability to forgive or overcome anger or whatever it might be, we have to just say to ourselves, this world is made from Om. There is nothing fixed about it. Brahma is recreating through the Om at every moment. And even though I have been this way for millions of incarnations, there's no reason in the world why 1 second from now I can't be different. And even if 1 second from now we're not completely different, we can still hold that thought in our mind at all times that this is who I'm going to become. Swami Kriyananda said, if you're going to judge yourself, and then he adds, which I don't recommend, he said, any fixed point that you can see, this is who I am, this is what I've done, by definition, by the time you can see it, it's already moving behind you. Isn't that a fascinating way to think about it? You know, I'm old enough now to not be young. When I pranam, it just takes a little bit more thought of how to get off the floor. I used to just spring up, and now I have to stop and think which part of my legs is still strong enough. I'm just at that teetering point, pushing towards 70, not there yet, but pushing from the backfield enough where pieces of my body are not working like they used to. You know, it's just like I'm old enough to know that nothing lasts. It doesn't change. But bring that down to the tiniest piece of yourself. Even if in the next second you're not different, you will be in the second after that. So Swamiji said, don't look at what you've already done or not done. He said, look at where you're going. Look at what you aspire to become. Because what you aspire to become is where your energy is heading. And that defines you much more truly than anything that you've already seen. Shiva already has his hands on it. It's already been created, it's been there for a while, and Shiva has gotten it, and he's throwing it back into the Ganges. And the more easily, and I will talk about that part of it, the more easily we just say, let's just create it anew, let's just start over. I remember once in my spiritual life, well, I went through this cycle more than once, but once when I went through this cycle, I just let myself make a whole lot of wrong decisions. They were wrong decisions mostly internally about my attitudes. And so I wasn't where I wanted to be. I felt that I was very far from attunement. And I wasn't feeling very joyful as a result. I was judging lots of things and lots of people. It was a bad idea. And I was beginning to feel that kind of, nothing ever works out. Why do I always keep making the same mistakes? You know, that one where, you know, Satan grabs you and just pulls you down into a pit. And you fall into that particular vritti and then you spin there for a while. And I was feeling pathetic and helpless right there. And then it crossed my mind that I myself had created this. And it was the simplest thing in the world for me to create something else. And I just had this picture of having walked away from where I wanted to be, and all I had to do was turn around and walk back. And really, no matter how complicated, you could be bankrupt, divorced, fired from your job, sick in bed, whatever it is, you got yourself there. Just turn and go in the direction that you need to go from there. It will be different because it's ever new, and we have to create it. And part of what was happening for me at that point was I was rejecting a lot of people. I just decided that I didn't like anybody. That's a very short version. And I had to go to a local supermarket. And you know, the stores where they have the long aisles. And sometimes you can see somebody in one of those aisles, and if you don't want to meet them, you can kind of turn and pretend that you haven't seen them. So I was at that store, and I saw this man and woman there. And I really didn't like them. I didn't like a lot of things about them. I found them unpleasant. And shortly after I'd had that understanding, so I was just about to duck around the corner. And then I remembered, this is exactly the way of being that got you to this point. This is not going to work. So I turned and I went down the aisle, and I just created a new reality, which was, I'm so glad to see you. And I immediately, instead of thinking about all the ways that they were icky, I started thinking about the things that were good. We had a lovely conversation and strangely developed this really close bond that never broke after that. We didn't become, let's spend a lot of time together friends, because we really had little in common. But it was like I stepped right into it and just created a new attitude. And it was almost from that moment, everything just began to roll again in the right direction. The oddest thing is, you see, here's the secret. This is the last thing I'll say before we take a break. When we're moving away from divine truth, it's like swimming upstream. Near Ananda Village in California, there's the Yuba River, and we would go sometimes in the summer and swim in the river. Swimming upstream in a river is a very interesting experience. You work, you work, you work, you think you've made so much progress, and you look and you see you're virtually exactly where you were, and you've gone nowhere. You turn around and swim with the current, and just the slightest little dog paddle, and you're just shooting down the river as far as you want to go. When we work against our own bliss, it's a tremendous uphill effort. And so we imagine that to reverse it is equal. But you see, in fact, that doesn't take into account, let's call it God's grace, that as soon as we start moving toward the divine, then we're flowing with the current of our own nature. And the way Swami Master put it once, actually, I'm contradicting myself here. He said, karma doesn't work the same for devotees. He said, because God takes a hand in it. So we don't have to pay off every debt exactly, because God goes to the bank and he writes a check. And so we come in and rediscover the balance isn't as big as we thought it was. And so for me, in that very small moment, I realized I'll just recreate myself. I have been this person who was closed toward these realities, but it's not working for me. And it's completely in my hands. Ever new, that's the symbol of Brahma. Om is ever reforming this universe. Let me step into that flow instead of holding myself close to it. And what we aspire to be, we become. Now, let's take a tea break, about 15 minutes, and then we'll come back. There's one more. There's a few people who haven't come back in yet. They will. There's a couple of more thoughts that I had about the creative side of life that's really important for us to understand. We have to appreciate that this being an energy universe, our thoughts generate a certain magnetism. Swamiji has often made this distinction, which is a really important one to understand. He talks about it in terms of money, or at least hearing it in terms of money is one of the ways that I really captured it. He wrote a book he called Money Magnetism, which is a very interesting title when you really contemplate it. And he was talking about it in terms of success in general, that it's not so much that we accomplish things as that we put out the right magnetism, and then the opportunities and the ideas and the resources that we need are magnetized to us. Sometimes people would call that lucky, but that's not really what it is. It's that when we put ourselves in the right frame of mind, the solutions are then literally just drawn from the universe and become part of our reality. This is where doing creative artistic work is often a very serious spiritual teacher, because we'll begin to understand that if we can just get ourselves aligned, then all of a sudden we'll know what to do. And people get into a certain creative flow, whether it's in your work or in relationships. It happens more than just informal, than just formally creating things. You get into that flow. By the same token, you see, if our thoughts are always... Well, let me just finish it this way. So when I was talking earlier about that understanding of the Brahma dimension is to realize that every moment it's being recreated in a new way, and it's being recreated according to the direction of our energy, because we're pulling in those opportunities, those thoughts, those feelings. So by the same token, if our mind is constantly tilting toward a lack of faith in the ever-renewing positive nature of life, then we just keep creating that same reality. Because creation isn't only in one direction. We can create a worse and a worse and a worse understanding. We are so careless with our thinking. We're not nearly, you know, if we were as careless with our clothes and our house and our money as we are with our thoughts, we would all be impoverished. I left the ashram this morning and Devendra carefully locked the front door. We go out the gates and the gates are carefully closed. Everybody knows that we have to secure our assets from being drained away from us. But our primary asset is our state of mind. And we're constantly just throwing it away. I had a friend who is a very fine person, very sincere spiritually, very talented, and she has one fault. And that fault is that she constantly feels that she's not adequate. And so no matter what she does, it never gives her joy, because her real thought always is that it's not adequate. And so she keeps imagining that someday she'll get everything together and then she'll be adequate and then she'll feel good. But of course, she's constantly affirming that she's inadequate, and therefore that's what she keeps drawing to herself. It's just a complete cancellation. So I said to her, because she liked to go camping a lot, I said, if you were in your tent somewhere, and in our country a rattlesnake came in, and that rattlesnake bit you on the wrist, you would immediately realize that you are in a life-threatening situation. And you would not stop and think, oh, you know, I just really am not a person who can cope with this. You know, I wonder why this is happening to me. There would be no intervening thought. You would recognize this is life or death. You would get rid of that rattlesnake and you would do everything you could to preserve yourself. I said, you have to understand that every time you allow your mind to say, oh, it's not working for me, I said, you are in a life and death struggle for your own happiness. And you need to treat that moment like the same emergency as if a poisonous snake had his fangs into your wrist. You see that? And so it's a very important, again, this is the Brahma side, we have to create the right state of consciousness and not think that it's okay just to, in this moment, complain about myself and say that I'm not really good at these things. You know, I have a personal theory about spiritual progress, which I, every time I say this, I have to say this is just the gospel according to Asha, and nobody of any real reputation has ever said this is true. But after spending a lot of years of my life waiting to be good enough to feel good about myself, whether it was how long I meditated, how nice I was to people, how much creative work I did, I mean, just make a list. I was always waiting till at least some of those were more in line before I was willing to just be happy and say it was okay. Wait just a second there, the thought went away. Oh, and one day I gradually, several things happened at the same time. I realized that I was tired of waiting. And I didn't seem to be getting any better at any of those things either. So I was tired of waiting, and there seemed no end to how long I was going to have to wait. So I decided to be happy anyway. I decided to be a mediocre person who accomplished very little, but was pretty cheerful about it. And I realized that I don't think we ever really get any better. I think we just stop worrying about it. And it just, the same mess just sits over there. It's just that we live over here now. And of course, truthfully, once you start being cheerful and have positive expectations, you develop magnetism. And in actual fact, a lot of those things do get better because most of what's wrong with them is the mindset that we're creating in relation to them. This is where the Brahma aspect of life, it's always being recreated. I'll just make a new definition. I actually went through a period of time in my life where I decided that I would never accomplish anything. And I hadn't accomplished anything at that point, so it was real easy to know what that looked like. And that I was never going to accomplish anything, that when I died, I would have to stand in front of Master and say, yep, nothing much happened. And I actually practiced that. I practiced my life review, in which we stood together and I said, yeah, no, I didn't quite do that. Nope, not that either. Nope, not that one either. But I was happy, and I was nice to a lot of people because I was happy, and I just practiced that being okay. I'm going to just completely diverge because there's this wonderful death and return story by a man named Dr. Ritchie. And he died of the flu when he was a young soldier in World War II. There was an influenza epidemic that went through his base camp in Texas, and he died and went to the other side. And he was about 20 or maybe 22. He was a Christian. And when he died, he found himself standing there in front of Jesus. And he said there was a 360-degree panorama of his entire life from the moment of conception until that moment. It was all happening simultaneously, like a big movie theater. And he had not been a very nice person. His mother had died, his father had remarried, his stepmother had tried very hard to take care of him, his grandparents didn't want him to accept his stepmother, he let them influence him, he was mean to lots of people. There was almost nothing to be proud of in that circle. And he was very embarrassed, he said, standing in front of Jesus. And the only good thing he saw in that whole panorama was he had been an Eagle Scout and he had done something good. So he had this idea in his mind. This is how he described it. He kind of made his body look really big like this to cover up as much of his life as he could. And he leaned over and pointed at the one good thing that he could see on the wall like this. And the way he tells this story, he had a Southern accent. And he said instantly he could tell Jesus knew exactly what he was doing. And he said, the Savior was amused. Instead of being upset or angry or anything, he was amused. And he began to chuckle. And Dr. Ritchie, in that moment, just felt all the love and acceptance that is really God's attitude toward us, and realized that all of this shame and guilt and sense of inadequacy was not coming from God. It was coming entirely from him. And he said in that moment, he just let go. Let go of all fear, let go of all self-judgment, and just recreated himself in that moment. And of course, then he came back and had a very long and fruitful career as a doctor after that. Anyway, so that is what, when we think about what we have to create, above all, what we have to create, now let me say it in the right way, is we have to create the right relationship with God. And the right relationship with God is to see it from his point of view. You know, we're just as good as we can be. For this hour was I born. If I could be different, I would be different. And to think that the divine is against us, Swamiji put it to me once when I was all snarled up in my head. He said, God doesn't want you to be unhappy. He said, that's your idea. And that, it took me many years before I really understood what he was saying to me, because I kept thinking that if I kept having bad thoughts about myself, suddenly I would become good. What a weird idea when you think of it like that. So that's what the Om is constantly doing. The Om is just flowing, and every moment is ever new. And as soon as Master said, a saint is a sinner who never gave up. But what we have to give up above all is this limited idea of our own nature. Okay? Very important. Now we come to the Vishnu aspect of things, which in our conversation today really just means the fact that there is a sustaining force in the universe, and sometimes that is where we find ourselves. For many people, that's a very, very difficult part of life. And often people prefer tragedy and chaos and argument and drama and emotion just to the day-to-day reality of what we have to do. I think many people's aspirations crash against the drudgery of everyday life. And every job that you ever get involved in, no matter how exciting it is, there's always a piece of it where it just comes down to this just simply has to be done. Now, the whole sustaining aspect of life is not only about drudgery. It's also about understanding that a certain balance has to be maintained. And many, we all have different temperaments. And it's very helpful if you know essentially what your flow is to find a way that you can work in that temperament. And some people are just very good at just, not necessarily at creating from nothing, but once something is there, of just knowing how to just keep it on an even keel, keep the energy flowing at all times. I had a project that I chose to do in my own house once. It was actually, we moved into a different place of residence. And when I came to India, I bought curtains and window coverings here because they were so much less expensive, and took them all back. So I arrived at home with all of these window treatments and no workmen to put them up. And I just, for some reason, some wacky reason, decided that I would do it myself. It was like, if it's worth doing, it's worth doing badly. This was exactly what I decided to do. And I didn't understand why I felt so drawn to do this, but I really learned something from it. Because I'm just not competent that way. But I have friends who are, and instead of letting them do it, I let them train me. So I had to go all through the house, all these windows, and figure out how to put the rods up and how to put the screws in, and then how to fix it when I put it up wrong, and all the different things that I had to do. And it took me quite some time, and when you come to visit our house, you'll see that some of them are a little askew and some of them are half falling off, but mostly they're okay. But because it was work that I never do, and because it's work that I have no relationship to doing well, I'm not going to become a home repair person. It's just too late, and I don't have the talent to do it. It just became a very, what I would call just a nameless necessity to put out energy day after day just to make the world go forward. I mean, I was, in a sense, creating something, but I wasn't really. And I realized that everything in life comes down to what I've called the patient application of willpower. And all three of those words became really fixed in my mind for this whole Vishnu aspect of life, which is it isn't this thrilling, creative thing where you're in this great energy and something completely new is happening and you're having the satisfaction of all of that. And it isn't the challenge of letting go when God has announced to you that nothing you expected to happen is going to happen. It's just the necessity to keep your energy high, keep your expectations positive, and keep your faith there that I can just persevere through this. And if I just the patient application of willpower, then in the end, everything will come together. Now, patient is one of the most important words when we're dealing with the Vishnu aspect of things, because that's where we lose it. We just want it to be different. We don't want to have to just go on in this way. Of course, we can recreate our own consciousness, but nonetheless, there's that patience. I have been asked countless times in many different forms by many different people essentially the same question. I'm not meditating as much as I should. I'm too impatient with my husband. I feel I'm annoyed with my job, whatever it might be. Give me a way to make it different. Okay? And the answer I always give is persevere, don't quit. And then they say, give me a way to make it different. And I say, persevere, don't quit. And then they say, give me a way to make it different. Because we're always thinking that somehow we can skip this whole middle stage. And this whole middle stage is the patient application of willpower. I was reflecting this morning, just trying to even cognize the years I've spent on the spiritual path. Or let me use Swami Kriyananda as an example first. Sometimes people have said to Swamiji, how many challenges you had in your life, how difficult it was, and this, the different things, the conflict he had with his own guru bhais, the endless necessity to make money, all the different people he had to coordinate and find creative ways to serve them, just all the traveling, endless health issues from a very early beginning, just his body, he ran so much karma through his body, even from his childhood. So he was always creating enormously through a physical vehicle that was fighting him in one way or another. But people would sort of try to quantify all those challenges, and he would always look really puzzled. Really? Has it been difficult? And he never saw it like that. He said it was just what had to be done. When he started Ananda in 1968, 69, right at that time, arthritis started developing in both his hips. And for the next 20 years, that arthritis just continued to develop. And so much so that Swami had a very unusual gait. And I used to often help with his clothes. And you always had to hem the pants legs differently, because if you hem them even, they were uneven, because of the degeneration of his hips. And it was a huge thing. Finally, he had an operation and had hip replacement. Eventually, he had both hips replaced. After the second hip operation, someone gave him a T-shirt that said, hip, hip, hooray. And when the doctors operated on him, the doctor said he had never seen a worse condition, that fully 2 inches of bone had been worn away. He said, I don't know how you could walk. He said, you should have been, you know, an invalid, complete invalid. And Swami was still just carrying on. And when he finally did this, when I was talking to him about it, I said, Swamiji, why didn't you have this done earlier? And his essential answer, I think the reason he didn't, seriously, was that he was carrying the karma for the founding of Ananda, and he was running the karma through his body. But he didn't say it exactly like that. He said it partially like that. But he essentially said, well, it just was one more thing that had to be dealt with. It was just one more thing. I was dealing with so many things trying to get Ananda established. This was just one more. And he didn't glorify it or distinguish it or cling to it or define himself by it. He had many things that he had to deal with, and this was just one of them. Now, on one hand, he was Brahma to the hilt because he was pulling from the ether something that had never been done before, which was Master's ideal of these householder communities. It was a completely new idea. It existed nowhere in time or space until he became the channel for it. But the other side of it was he was very Vishnu in his just constant, sustained, unrelenting, patient application of willpower. And his patience in doing that was one of the most notable features. Now, patience comes from faith. This is what we have to understand. If you really believe that this is going to work, and it is our spiritual salvation, or the project that you have, or the marriage that you're in, or the child you're raising, or the soup you're making, whatever it might be, if you really believe it's going to work, then where is the cause for anxiety? So that patience is generated from a very high level. And ridiculous as it was, I really learned this putting up those curtain rods, because I found out if you put all the screws in the wrong place, you could take the whole thing down, and you could get that little spackle stuff, and you could put it all in there, and you could get the little can of paint, and you could paint it all over again, and then you could figure out where it really went, and you could do it again. It was just a question of doing it. And sooner or later, they would be hung. Now, I took that lesson on a very deep level in my own life. I'm trying to write a book. I'm trying to get someone to understand an idea. I'm trying to work out an issue with how do we solve this whole question. I'm trying to figure out what country to travel in. Okay, if I believe that Brahma is ever recreating the universe, and if it's not there, it will be there, then I can just quietly and patiently just keep pushing on it. But the other word there is application. You have to energetically add to it. And if it's there in front of you and it has to be done, it serves us nothing to have a mindset that says, oh, here I am again. You know, or I'm not able to do this as well as I should. A friend of mine, disciple of another path, found herself assigned by her guru, as it were, to run this retreat. And she was not very good at administrating and holding groups together. Prior to that, she had been a traveling teacher. She said she was ideally suited to be a traveling teacher because, I'll quote her, she was very good at loving people and then leaving them. But she was not good at sitting there and having to make them all happy. And she was very anxious about the job. And so one day in meditation, she prayed to her guru and she said, she exaggerated the accent when she told me, you want this job done better, you get somebody else. If this is what you want, then leave me here and I'll keep doing it. And then it was like, this is not my problem. God has put me here, and I will now just apply whatever energy I can to doing this. I will patiently apply this energy, and that's the best that I can do here. And then comes the word willpower. Because what is it that keeps us from wanting to do this? It's all of those other vrittis that say, I'll never succeed, I don't like this, this is not the full use of my talents, I was born for something else, it's their fault, they're so icky, it's not really my fault. And willpower isn't just toward the project itself. The willpower we have to exert is to just accept reality as it is, that this is what I need to do, and this is what I'm going to have to do now. And then we apply the Brahma energy to make it enjoyable. A friend of mine who has an enormous intelligence and a great deal of willpower, in the course of working for the ashram, found himself for almost a year running the copy machine, which by any measure was way, way underutilizing his abilities. But he found himself day to day just having to mostly work at the copy machine. And once he accepted that this is really what he was going to have to do, he started using Brahma energy to make it as much fun as he could. He made up little dance routines that he would do between the sheets like this. He began to make up songs that would match the rhythm of the copy machine. You know, he just, everything he could do just to make it interesting. I was driving through a toll booth once in San Francisco, and one of the toll people had music in their ears, and I don't know what they were listening to, but it was very, very lively. And they were so busy taking my money, you know, and you could just see that they were stuck in this unbelievably repetitive, uninteresting job, but it had to be done. This person clearly, this was the best job they could get. This is what they had to do. Now, you see, it's always a balance. If we're always expecting that somehow Om has only one aspect, which is the one I like the best, you can see you're always out of step. So it just is part of the reality. Swami Kriyananda persevered on a level that is almost impossible to comprehend. He was persevering not only against external obstacles, but just against the absolute commitment that this is what I'm asked to do. And it just doesn't really matter what it looks like. He tells the story of once when he'd worked so hard to get the first land, and he had borrowed money to do it, a mortgage to do it, and he was paying it off. And then somebody saw the opportunity perhaps to take the land from him and suddenly demanded a great sum of money very quickly, and he wasn't listening to reason. The man was just being greedy. And this news came to Swamiji, and he was just so intense about it. And this woman said to him, oh, you know, come over to my house, we'll have a cup of tea. And she used the phrase, you'll feel better, remember? And Swami just answered, I don't care how I feel. The only thing I want to know is, what am I going to do about this? Now, of course, you're drawing on a creative solution, but first you have to just tune into that fact that the energy has to be sustained. You just have to sustain the energy. One of our departments, our school in Palo Alto, we went through this period of great confusion. There was conflict among the personnel, and it was very rocky for a while, and it looked like the school might be severely affected. In the end, it wasn't. But Helen and Gary and I, who were three of the key players, we just sort of looked at each other and we said, you know, if the whole thing falls to pieces, after the whole thing falls to pieces, we'll still be standing here. We're not going anywhere. We're just going to persevere doing what we think is right and let the universe just decide around us what it wants to do. And when it does, we'll adjust to it. And it was and I'm moving into the Shiva energy, but this is the two forces coming together. If you have trained yourself, you see, in the patient application of willpower, when Shiva takes an interest in you and suddenly decides to dynamite your life in one way or another, whether it's from internal experiences or external experiences, what causes us to panic when those changes come is that we imagine that something has actually happened. My husband taught me a very good lesson when I very first met him. He has a temperament that is different than mine. I've, by the grace of God, moved more into his temperament, which is one of the advantages that can happen if you know people well. But I was a creative type, and I was very good in the creative period and very impatient as soon as it was over. And his point of view was, everything is energy. Just as simple as that. Everything is energy. He said, and whether the energy is going this way or this way or this way or this way, everything is Om. It's all different aspects of Om, and it all weaves together to make the whole. And so every morning you wake up and you look at what's in front of you. And you can divide it up into all sorts of things, or you can just say, I'll just put out energy today. Once I dragged him to an astrologer who wasn't very good, as it happened, anyway. But when we walked out, he turned to me, and in his sweet way, he said, let's not waste money on this sort of thing anymore. And then he said, what difference would it make? He said, I get up in the morning, I do the best I can do. He said, I'm not going to behave differently just because I have other information in my head. Me, I like to know lots of stuff. But for him, it's all energy. So if things are succeeding and what's the energy required is very creative and exciting, that's great. If you're in the dull middle of every project, or if your temperament and your responsibility is just to keep everything in balance, then it's just energy. I just keep it in balance. If what I have to go through now is deep disappointment in myself or my circumstances, if everything has not turned out the way I want, I just get up in the morning and do the best I can do. What we have to understand about this third aspect of Om, which is the third aspect of creation, nothing stays the same. It's so self-evident, and yet we are so blinded to it. It's just the most remarkable thing to me, and I watch it in myself, how much we try to make things stay the way they are, and how deeply we want our point of view to be enforced on the universe. And of course, the patient application of willpower and acting with the Brahma energy is part of it. But sometimes change is the creative response. Sometimes change is even the sustaining response. I started with the story of that man whose life was just suddenly ended with 2 weeks' notice. You know, what was he really relying upon? I went through a project with Swami Kriyananda. It was in 1982. Our community of Ananda is set in the middle of a rural area, Ananda Village. And our neighbors were not supportive of what we were trying to do. And so every time we wanted to build or change our plans, there would be a big outcry from the neighbors, and then everybody would have to go before the county authorities. There would be big arguments back and forth. It was exhausting, and it also made it difficult to go forward. So we researched California law and found out that the only legal entity that has control over its own land use is a California city. And we researched the law and found out that what qualifies as a city is on paper, is a paper definition that can be applied to situations that don't look anything like cities. So we had a 900-acre farm, really, but we could qualify as a California city by just doing a few small things. So Swamiji decided that we should do this. And he put me in charge of the project with two other women who both happened to be lawyers, so we had good minds at work on it. And we started on this extremely audacious project of turning our little community into a California city. Now, to say that the neighbors did not like that idea is putting the smallest possible words on the issue. It was bedlam. And for 18 months, I and my two women friends, we just worked on this project like this all the time. I actually got death threats. That's how bad it got. I mean, they were not real, but people's feeling was so strong. And we finally started having the last public hearings. We started in a hall that held 200, then we moved to a hall that held 300. By the last hearing, we were in the biggest auditorium in the city. There were like 900 people there, all of whom opposed it, except for us. Nobody wanted us to do it. We should have been granted it because we were within our rights, but the hoo-ha was just too much, and the county officials just couldn't vote for us. But they broke a lot of laws in the process of denying it. So as soon as it was over, I'm on the microphone in front of the media and my lawyer friends are with me and we're going to sue and this has happened and we really have to have this. We were. The next morning, a television crew from Sacramento, the capital a few hours away, is coming to interview Swami Kriyananda about this big thing. I mean, it was really big news by this. The way Ananda was constituted then, especially, you couldn't find Kriyananda's house, so I met the crew a mile and a half away and got in the car with them, and all the way I'm telling them how we're going to fight this, and it didn't come out right, and, you know, I'm very good at this. So we get up to Swami's, and I come in, and Swami says to the crew, he says, if you'll give me just, you know, like, five unbroken minutes, I have an announcement to make. And I sort of look at him. We didn't have telephones, I should add. Cell phones didn't exist, and we didn't have telephones. So there was no way that Swami could have communicated to me. So I look at Swami like, huh, what is this? Jyotish, who's standing there also, sort of mouths to me, you don't know? I said, no, I don't know. No what? Like this. Swami starts reading this announcement. I'm a wordsmith. In the first sentence, I can tell the project is now in the past tense. And then he goes on to explain that even though it was not done properly, in fact, Ananda was not constituted for political reasons. We were constituted for spiritual reasons. And he thinks the process was wrong, but the decision was right. When you mix religion and politics, it's not a good idea. Subsequent events in America are showing that to be really true. So he conceded and let the whole project go. A second later, the newsman put the microphone in front of me, and I have to say, why, yes, of course, this is absolutely the right idea. And then I go all the way back down the hill, explaining to them, like, yes, you know, when you consider it, this is... Then as soon as I wave goodbye, I get back in the car, I go back up the hill, and I go knock on Swami's door. What? You know, what is this? For 18 months, day and night, this is all that I had done. Just total, because there was so much force, we had to fight so hard. He said, well, I was meditating this morning, he said, and I held the project up to the light, and I clearly felt Master say, no, you've done enough. And you've accomplished what you needed to accomplish, which actually turned out to be we stood up against the neighborhood. And after that, things got a lot better. We didn't have to win in order to win. So Master said, enough. Really, it isn't a good idea. Don't become a political entity. Remain a spiritual entity only. And then I said to Swamiji, why didn't I get that message? I'm the one who's working on this. He said, did you ask? No, sir. I just assumed if it was true yesterday, it was true today. And I never really stepped back and said, just because it was true yesterday, is it true today? And as soon as I said, no, sir, I just laughed and just let it go. Now, then I had this wonderful, I mean, it was one of the most marvelous Shiva experiences I've ever had, because Swamiji just took it away from me like that, without so much as a what do you think. It was just gone, and I completely trusted him. Plus, I actually thought he was right when I stood back enough. So then I had to ask myself, this is what Shiva is about, what am I committed to? Swamiji had asked me to take on the project. The project suited me, and I enjoyed it. It was interesting. It taught me a great deal. It was lots of fun. It was also a really good idea for a while. But what was I attached to? And I realized I was attached to doing what I felt God wanted me to do, which in my life has been a lot of what Swamiji has asked me to do. Not that I'm mindlessly obedient, but what Swami asks me to do when I feel it inside myself has always been what I have felt was also right. But what I'm attached to is doing what's right and what God wants. And if He shifts that, why would I cling? Why would I cling for even a heartbeat? What am I really attached to? And that particular cycle, what happened after that was I got very sick. I rarely get sick, and I had a really high fever. And I was in bed for a few days with a high fever, which has happened 3 times maybe in my whole life. And when I got up from the fever, just like the whole project was gone. It's like I just burned out all of it. But I finally came to Swamiji and I said, here's what I'm still attached to. No, prior to getting sick, I said to Swami, I don't mind losing, but it annoys me that they won. I was attached to not letting those people get their way. I still had that angst about it. Then I got the fever. And when I got up from the fever, I didn't care anymore. The only thing I want, the only thing any of us want, is to be in tune with Spirit. Now, how can we tell whether we're in tune with Spirit? Well, one way is to pay attention to what happens to you. Because we can have all the good ideas in the world. And if they're not in the divine flow, God is going to challenge us. Now, you have to have the patient application of willpower. You don't just fold up at the first hint of trouble. But when it's clear that Om is taking another route, and that aspect of Om has come in that's just going to dissolve this, whatever it was, it's just not going to be there anymore, then what are we really attached to? And if we're only attached to that divine, that's what that man, he was so remarkable, the man I started with who died. It was like he was attached. It would be hard to say what he was attached to, but he was just attached to being dynamically present. That's what made him a successful businessman. That was what made him a happy hedonist. And when it was time for him to die, he just gave himself completely to the moment in front of him. And now it was death. And he just embraced it with the same sort of limitless commitment that he'd shown to everything else. He turned out to be a far more spiritual person than his wife, in many ways, at least apparently. So with us, we can be absolutely certain that eventually the Om is going to ask us to be completely different. And the other thing you have to ask yourself is, what's so great about what I have now? And that's the funny thing. You know, we're limited in so many ways. We're so far away from God realization. And then when something happens that's going to strip something away from us, we cling so tightly to it, like, why? Why? Some of it is just like I was saying. I was 50 years old before I knew the difference between debate and conversation. When I was telling one of my exceedingly diplomatic friends about this, I mean, he couldn't stop laughing. Because to him, it had been so instinctive, you know, to encourage people and relate and all these different ways. And he just thought it was the funniest thing he'd ever heard, because that's not his particular delusion. He moves in a certain way. But every one of us has so many things we want to get rid of. And whether it's our pride or our sense of fairness, or I have had a karmic relationship that I've had to deal with for many years. And it's with people that I love dearly, with whom I am very close. But we have had past lives in which neither of us behaved all that well. But I'm much more conscious of how they behaved rather than how I behaved. And, you know, those little things come up. It's like you can watch it again. But I just have to say to myself, why would I not want the karma to balance? You have to ask yourself, why would I not want the karma to balance? Swamiji says we suffer. He says this so, it's just such an unadorned statement. It's in the Patanjali commentary. We suffer in the way we have inflicted suffering. When I read that on the page, I tried to find some wiggle room in that. You know, I held the page up to the light. I just tried to see, has he modified this in any way? It's just straight across. We suffer in the ways we have inflicted suffering. Why would I want that karmic balance not to be fixed? So God asks something of us that isn't really what we wanted to do. He takes what I call an unwelcome interest in our well-being. You know, lots of times I feel God's interest is quite unwelcome. You know, he's interested in liberating me at a time when I'm really not so interested in being liberated. Once, for a brief period of time, my husband was my boss, which was not a relationship that worked really terrifically, so we didn't stick with that very long. This was when we were both at Ananda Village, and he had to come one day and tell me that I needed to take on this certain assignment, and it was an assignment that really made me nervous, and I really didn't want that assignment, and I responded in a less than centered manner, and he was trying to mitigate the blow by saying, well, you don't really have to do this. I said, no, dear, I do have to do this. That's why I'm so upset. If I thought there was a way to get out of it, then I would just be very casual about it. But it's being trapped. And being that feeling itself is Shiva trying to say, what are you afraid of? You know, what do we think is on the other side of the known? It's just, and then you see everything, all of it, everything that I've said, all comes down to this flow of faith. Do I really think that I'm the only one here and that I'm really running this? I'm asked repeatedly about free will to the point where I've become quite impatient with the question. I'm trying to master myself on this one. But I actually finally heard one of the answers that Swami gave that I think is really the answer. Try to separate any aspect of your life from the entire fabric of creation. I wrote a letter to a friend, like, what did you have for breakfast this morning? Why was that food in your refrigerator? When did you buy it? Where did you buy it? Who delivered it to the store? Where did the store get it from? Why did the farmer grow it? How did that farmer happen to be on that farm? Who were his parents? When did they get that particular farm? And then why is it that you're, how much time you have, that you have to choose this ready-made cereal instead of this egg that you would have made? Somebody else is calling you. The metro leaves at a certain time. How are you going to separate the breakfast bowl that you had this morning from the entire fabric of the universe? Swamiji has said everything is predetermined. You'll go to your closet and pick a particular shirt, and there's just no other shirt that you could have picked at that particular point because all these forces are combining to make it just so. So the free will that we have is not to break the fabric of the universe. How could we possibly do that? But the free will we have is very simple. We either turn with receptivity to the flow of God's grace in our life, or we turn away from it. We either stand in the middle of that interrelated flow in which everything is connected and is happening in the only way it can and have a temper tantrum about it, or else we say, my, this is interesting. You know, look at this. I had experiences in the last couple of months in which I thought people were treating me just slightly unfairly. And afterwards, I realized at one point that many, many years ago, I had treated those same people in a way that they thought was unfair, and I had forgotten about it. And I thought, perfect. you know, the decision wasn't really reasonable in a certain sense, but it was also perfectly reasonable because there was a karmic debt to be paid. Why would I not be happy to have that karmic debt paid? That's what Shiva's doing for us. He's always balancing it. He's saying, this is over, this has to start. This isn't going to come out the way you want. It's going to come out another way. Just rise above it. Use your Brahma energy to create a new reality. Use your Vishnu energy to just persevere with the patient application of willpower so that when Shiva comes, you can say, just take it away. I stood once at Deva Prayag, I think it's called, on the way up to Jyotimat. We were going up to Badrinath. And you go down, 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 and you stand right where these two rivers come together. I mean, well, of course, that's what it is. I mean, those spots are beyond imagination of expectancy. There's so much power there. And I love India. In America, you wouldn't be able to get within 50 yards of the edge. In India, you can just walk right to the edge. Nobody's afraid of being sued. We just walk right to the edge. So I'm standing there, and it's like I'm not suicidal on any level, but it was so obvious to me that if I just put my foot into that river, whoosh, gone. Just the whole incarnation would just end like that. And I didn't want to, and I knew there would be extreme consternation behind me if I did that. But it was such a liberating thought. That it can just be over. It's just, everything is so temporary. And from the point of view of the river, I could step into it and my body could be used up and the river wouldn't even notice. Just wouldn't even notice. And it's so freeing, really, to just see our little lives in that context. I was remembering, Swami says that Master said once, trying to get us to be more impersonal. Swami said that Master went like this, God eats people. And then Master went, oh, blah, 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 like that. You know, we think of a great guru. Blah, 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 blah. It was just eating people. And so when we get so precious about the little tiny things of our lives, just throw yourself into that river and realize it doesn't make any difference. The only thing that endures is our connection with God. The only choice we have is our connection with God. Just make that ironclad in your life and everything else will take care of itself. So, God bless you. I do understand the concept of Shudra.
You have to reach up to the Brahman.
Right.
So, is it something related to the text you explained?
Of the Brahma Vishnu?
Or it is different?
There probably is a way to relate it. In fact, I even think Swami does in his book. The way I like to think about the progression through the caste is a progression, yes, so it's of increasing creativity. So you do have to become more and more capable of, because the characteristic of a Shudra is there's no creativity at all. No thoughts occur to them that are outside of the self-evident. The Vaishya caste begins to use its willpower and its creativity for selfish purposes, but that's better than not using it. The Kshatriya uses its creative willpower and energy for the service of others, which is progress, and the Brahmin uses it only to tune into God. So in a sense, actually, all three are applicable at all times, but the Shudra is, yes, beneath the Brahmin level, hasn't really risen to it yet.
Yeah. Sometimes I see, you know, any person, and I realize that he's at Shudra level,
but a person can only progress, we can only see the vibration that we are capable of seeing. And truthfully, our capacity to realize that other people can only progress as fast as they progress is an important part of coming to peace with the fact that we can only progress as fast as we can progress. And in fact, too much agitation about others is usually a sign of unresolved agitation about oneself. And all of us have within us all four of those states of consciousness. We just, the spectrum moves up until we're entirely free. But it's all about being at peace with the fact that there is a divine flow and it is going somewhere and it does have a happy ending. But now we all just have to play our parts as best we can.
And only, I think the solution would be that the patience. The right time.
Exactly.
Is going to come for anyone.
If you can walk out of here with patient application of willpower, you'll be amazed. I've been amazed. How many times when I become agitated, I just get those three words and I realize, oh, that's the solution. And as soon as I just settle into that, there it goes again. All right? Tamakshi.
It's a, you know, when you were talking about the high fever that you had and then feeling like a certain karma was over with that, I wanted to ask, I heard you say at another point that Swamiji said sometimes it seems like
you're going to say, Swamiji said, sometimes people think they're going through a lot of karma, but it's really just something physical. No, I know. I've gotten so many letters about that. Whatever I said, I completely garbled because nobody understood what he said, and so I'm so glad to have another opportunity at least to fix it. Swamiji and I were just talking about spiritual progress and how people have a tendency to over-personalize and over-dramatize the things that are happening to them. And so every little nuance of consciousness in their mind is elevated to some great experience. Oh, you know, the reason that he spoke to me like that is because I think in 15 lifetimes I did this, and when will I ever get over it? You know, that sort of thing. So Swami was trying to say, sometimes you have a little indigestion and it's made your brain foggy. So you respond a little impatiently to something. It's just because you have a little indigestion and your brain is foggy. It's not because all of your karma is crescendoing in this particular moment. So the phrase he said was, sometimes people think it's really big karma, but it's just something physical. That's what he meant. He didn't mean that we never work out karma by physical means or that illnesses do not have greater significance. He was really saying, don't exaggerate every little wave of change inside of you, because sometimes it really doesn't mean anything. It's just the fact that we live in physical bodies and we have biorhythms and we're allergic to some of what we eat or we're dehydrated, and it doesn't mean anything more than that. Okay? Thank you for asking. I think I've hardly ever had such an onslaught of misunderstanding, thank God. Now I have to publish what I just said to you everywhere so the letters will stop. Because everybody's now afraid that everything they thought they had worked out, they didn't. Okay.
Yes. One more thing. I also wanted to ask about this idea of doing the best you can do.
Yes.
Sometimes it's not clear what that means because your mind tells you, oh, you can do better, or you know, here's a solution, and your willpower is not able to catch up to that, or you're emotionally not in a place, you're not sure, am I indulging myself, or can I genuinely not bring my energy up there at this moment? Like, how do you, what's a good gauge?
You know, that's a very, the answer to that, at least I'll speak from my own experience, is really quite subtle, which is, if you're really working, if we're talking about any kind of job, and you're working sincerely, in a sense of relationship to the divine, you feel really comfortable with what you've done. And all of that self-analysis and self-doubt just doesn't enter the picture. And the mere fact of all that analysis and self-doubt is usually in itself proof that you need to just put all that aside. because that is not how truth is arrived at, by weighing this against this and doubting this against that and measuring yourself against this. That's just this endless circle of just thinking, thinking, thinking. Whereas if you really have worked with sincerity and goodness, you just know that you've done the best you can. And if you have another good idea, maybe you should do it, but your common sense begins to tell you. You don't get so sucked into just all these theoretical possibilities. Somehow, there's a point at which you just begin to relax and realize it was okay. And if it was not as good as I could have done, next time I'll do better. But if I could have done it better, I would have done it better. The problem is not the question you're asking. The problem is the loop in the mind that causes you to continually ask the question. That's what has to be broken back into more of an intuitive flow. You're a creative person, so you know the difference. And the difference is just get back into that flow, and then it'll be obvious. And if you're not in that flow, there's no point in... Nothing good's going to come anyway from that. I don't know if that really answers it or not, but I think that is. Because I used to worry like that all the time, and then one day I just stopped. And I realized I stopped because I had just relaxed into a flow of energy. And when I was in a relaxed flow of energy, when I suddenly moved out of that, I could see that that was the problem. You see the difference? I hope that helps. It's a great freedom when it works, finally. Yes, sir.
When we say who I am, I'm confused. What is I? That is mind or soul? And when we say, if I presume, as per the scriptures, that I am a soul, then soul is pure energy. And that energy is working through the mind. Because the mind is being working as per the because of this energy. Then this is being pure energy. Then how the impurities come in the mind or soul? It's confusing. What is the relationship between mind and soul?
This is how Master described it, which is, I think, is a really good answer. He said, every level of reality exists on its own level. So there can be the pure level of complete union with the spirit. There can be the delusion that enters the mind that I am identified with the body and with the ego and acting in this way. And they can all exist at the same time. And it just depends on what level of reality you're tuned into. As Master said, if you're having a dream, and in your dream head hits a dream wall, then you will have a dream pain. And as long as you're in that dream, it will really be happening. And then Master went further to say, you have to be able to relate appropriately to every level of reality. So when you are responding with the I being connected to fluctuating realities that are not eternal, if you are relating to them as if they were there, you have to relate appropriately to that level. And when you no longer perceive it that level, it won't be a question for you. But as long as you're experiencing it, you have to relate to it. And that's the clearest I can say about how they can all be happening at the same time. For me, they're not. For, you know, they're happening. This is what's happening, and I have to learn to be here. I can't escape from this level by pretending it's not there because I'm living on it.